The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
I think the first step is to work with the local governments and see what is feasible. The second step is to look at the range of tools short of uses of force that might be available to respond to the zombies and to contain them. And then if we come to a situation where the president and our best intelligence agents say, and our best operators say, this is not feasible, we need to use other extraordinary measures, it certainly seems to me that at least the president has Article 2 authorities to protect against the zombie threat spreading and threatening U.S. persons. And if it turns out that the zombies continue to pose an ongoing threat that can't be addressed through other tools, then the president ought to go to Congress and get an authorization.
I'm Shane Harris of Foreign Policy Magazine, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 30th, 2014. Today on the podcast, it's the special Zombie Apocalypse edition. Zombies are the hot thing in horror films and TV right now. The Pentagon has drawn up plans to repel a zombie invasion. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has a zombie preparedness page on its website. And the noted international relations theorist Dan Dresner has written a book about how different schools of international relations theory would treat a zombie apocalypse. The legal implications of fighting the Walking Dead, however, have really gotten short shrift in the discussion. Until now, that is. With me today is a heavyweight panel to consider the legal architecture of the war on zombies. We've got Lawfare's Bobby Chesney and Benjamin Wittes, and we've got Just Security's Jennifer Daskal to discuss what the law owes to the ghouls who are coming to chow down on your brains. It's the Lawfare Podcast, Episode 89, Bone-Crushing Zombie Action.
Ben, I want to pose the first question to you. And at a very basic level, I want to ask you, why are we talking about this? Why are we talking about the need to develop legal policies around the threat of zombies?
Well, I think it's, you know, an area that has acquired a lot of prominence in popular culture all of a sudden. 10 years ago, we weren't talking about zombies. But now, you know, there are television shows, there are movies, there's a, you know, runaway bestseller book. And so, you know, whereas a few years ago it was all about vampires, right now zombies are in. And the result has been a set of pretty serious considerations of zombies and the national security threat and global security threat that they pose in some fairly serious places. As you noted in the introduction, the Pentagon has considered this issue. The CDC has considered it. And I think we would be irresponsible, particularly late in the summer when, you know, people are off on Labor Day weekend and kind of looking for amusing things to talk about, we'd be irresponsible not to consider what the legal architecture of a war on zombies is going to look like.
So that leads into the next question then. Do you think that we need to have an authorization to use military force against the zombies? And if you do, what do you think that would look like? And then I want to go around and ask Bobby and Jen that question too.
So this gets to, I think, one of the really hard questions about zombies, which is, are they human or not? if you imagine that they're human, it becomes very difficult to authorize long-term uses of force against people without serious congressional involvement. On the other hand, if you think of them as kind of inanimate objects, you know, the president really on his own authority, particularly if he's operating on U.S. domestic soil, kind of has the authority to blow up inanimate objects, assuming that there's no property rights involved. And, you know, we don't have an authorization to sort of do things on the Nevada test site, right? So I think it really depends whether zombies have legal personhood.
Well, Bobby, what do you think on that question? I mean, and both, do they need an AUMF, and what do you think about the personhood question? Are zombies people? They certainly were people once.
They were once, and depending on the what the CDC can and the WHO can bring to bear here, they might become people again at some point down the road. It just depends.
So there could be a cure, in other words, for zombies.
There could be, which complicates things a bit. It's comparable to de-radicalization, perhaps. Are these people who, what does it take to vitiate zombie status? But I'm getting away from the AMF question. Let me talk about it in terms of the president's Article II authority. And it seems to me here we have to talk about the classic 19th century case, In re Nagel, which aficionados of separation of powers and those who study national security law using the Dicus Banks, Vladeck, Raven Hansen book, you know, everyone reads this case in which Supreme Court Justice Stephen Field was on a train in California, and there was as it's reported in the case, there's this angry, disgruntled individual that they knew was coming after him, and the court held that it was within the power of the president to provide for the use of force to defend Stephen Field, in this case a marshal who shot the assailant. Without any authorization, and this is kind of taken as an example of what you might call force protection and the authority of the president on his own initiative to use force. What people don't know, but some recent archival research suggests, was this was a zombie incident. This was a circumstance in which the assailant, the cover story the government produced was that he was had this personal vendetta. It was in fact a carnivorous zombie that tried to eat Stephen Field's brain, which of course, Justice Field's brain is no ordinary brain. It was especially robust and therefore very appealing to zombies. So we actually have an example of the Supreme Court approving at least a limited use of force in what appears to have been a zombie case.
So, Jen, taking that precedent into account, I mean, the question still is, I mean, do we need some special new authorization? I mean, it would almost sound like maybe we don't. You know, what do you think? And if we did have one, I mean, how would we start to craft that?
Right. So, I mean, before we even get to the question as to whether or not we need a separate authorization, I think we first need to understand what the threat is and whether this is the kind of threat that requires extraordinary law of war type of authorities, or whether our ordinary law enforcement tools, a range of counterterrorism tools, where the threat is emerging. Is the threat domestic? Is it international? How serious is the threat? Is it contained? Can our partners contain it? So I'd want to ask all those questions before we even get to the question as to whether or not we need an AUMF. And in terms of, and there's two separate questions. So one is if we're going to use force outside of the United States, and the other question is whether or not we're going to use force in the United States. In the United States, we have the Militia Acts and the Insurrection Acts that would at least seem to give the president the authority to take emergency measures even in the absence of some additional authorization domestically. But then there's a separate set of questions about international uses of force.
Well, maybe talk a bit about those, because, I mean, obviously, if we're talking about, let's sort of, for the sake of discussion, kind of put the zombies in two categories. So there are the zombies that we're dealing with domestically in the United States, and we have all kinds of tools from domestic law enforcement agencies, and, you know, we have our own constitution that we can perhaps, you know, address this with. But, you know, the zombie plague, if we want to call it that, spreads, right? It's a contagion, and so it doesn't really know any borders. So what do we do about, say, the hordes of zombies that are especially large and threatening in parts of Western Europe where they've been spotted, or in parts of Southeast Asia? How do we go about combating that threat, particularly if it seems like the governments there are either unable or unwilling to contain the contagion themselves?
So again, I think the first step is to work with the local governments and see what is feasible. The second step is to look at the range of tools short of uses of force that might be available to respond to the zombies and to contain them. And then if we come to a situation where the president and our best intelligence agents say, and our best operators say, this is not feasible, we need to use other extraordinary measures, it certainly seems to me that at least in the short term, in the face of some sort of threat to U.S. persons or an immediate crisis, the president has Article 2 authorities to take appropriate action to protect against the zombie threat spreading and threatening U.S. persons on the ground or looking like it's going to spread in some dramatic way that it's going to lead to additional attacks on the homeland. And if it turns out that the zombies continue to pose an ongoing threat that can't be addressed through other tools, then the president ought to go to Congress and get an authorization to deal with that.
So one question that I think, you know, requires settlement is whether you think about zombies as primarily a biosecurity matter that is analogous to Ebola or pandemic flu, which, you know, you tend to handle one way, or whether you think of it as analogous to, a counterterrorism, incident, in which case you think about sort of hordes of zombies as, you know, maybe sort of associated forces with the main group that you're attacking. And I think you would think about the problem very differently. And certainly in the past, countries that have confronted major zombie invasions have taken different approaches to that. You know, there are countries that have really considered it as a public health issue, and then countries that have really thought of it under wartime authorities, particularly, you know, the Burmese.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so, you know, we have the Centers for Disease Control here, and we have a lot that we can bring to bear on perhaps, you know, maybe go back to Bobby with this. I mean, talking about if we could find a cure for this. I mean, if science can point the path towards a time that we can predict where if we inoculated enough people, we'd either stop the spread or we might be able to turn people back. Do we have an obligation, either legally or morally, to pursue that scientific route before we go to a military option?
Well, you know, Shane, this may depend on whether we are categorizing the context as armed conflict or instead a situation in which international human rights law applies, in which case the necessity of using lethal force and the possible alternatives enters into the picture. And here's the thing, this particular threat, it's obviously not a state actor. So when we're determining whether the law of armed conflict is applicable here as a possibly dominant regime for what force we can use, it can't be international armed conflict unless it turns out that these are actually state-sponsored zombies, which we can't rule out at this stage.
Although only Haiti has ever been known as a state to sponsor zombies.
This is a good point, and I think that since that government at this point has collapsed in the weight of their own zombie problems, well, it could be a problem that got out of hand. But let's assume, for the sake of argument at least, it's not a Haitian-sponsored threat. In that case, we're talking at most about a non-international armed conflict. And here, if we apply the Tadic criteria, we have a little problem, because the scale of force that governments are contemplating using to deal with this potentially existential threat, well, that sounds like armed conflict, sounds like high-intensity forces contemplated. Certainly the means being employed, these are going to be military assets in many cases. But you don't have organization. As near as we can tell, as best the public record indicates, the zombies don't have a hive mind. They don't have a hierarchy. And it's not just they don't wear distinctive insignia and so forth. They're disorganized, and they may be the ultimate leaderless resistance. And in that circumstance, for those who want to prioritize and put a lot of weight on the Tadic criterion of organization of the enemy force, there's no one to be the other side. And indeed, this also connects up with the idea that we once used to hear about in connection with before there was the global war on zombies. Of course, we can all remember the global war on terrorism. Before the GWAS, there was the GWAT. This idea that maybe there's no end to it, because it's you're finding something that has no ability to cooperate with you in ending. And if that's the case, then maybe law of armed conflict doesn't apply, and we're left with something else. Maybe it's human rights law, and we have to start grappling with is there some non-lethal means that could return these zombies to a normal human state?
Let me ask you just a basic question here, too. You know, and I'm a journalist, I'm not a lawyer, but, I mean, can we even define it as armed conflict? I mean, the zombies are unarmed, right? I mean, they attack as a horde, and they're violent, but, I mean, maybe this is a dumb question, but in order for the law of armed conflict to apply, do they need to actually be armed and carrying weapons and posing a threat that way, or is it enough that they swarm on people and kill them by, you know, biting into their skulls and eating their brains?
I think, you know, first we have to acknowledge that some of them literally are unarmed and that they have no arms.
Right.
But that said, as you point out, their teeth, especially, very, very dangerous. I don't think we would think that this makes them hors de combat. It doesn't take them out of combat because they have not manifested intent to surrender. Indeed, they've manifested intent to eat your brains is what they've manifested. And though their weapons are unconventional, I think we have to, as technology and other changes change what it means to have a deadly weapon. We used to talk about this in connection with whether certain cyber weapons could count as armed attacks. I think we have a dental variant of that here.
I was just going to ask, I want to ask Jen, so obviously, you know, there are responses to the zombies. I mean, we attack the zombies, we fight, get back against the zombies. And one of the things that has, you know, come up repeatedly in these discussions is the issue of collateral damage. You know, it's fairly easy to detect, at least at a reasonable distance, who is a zombie and who's not based on the way that they're walking and, you know, the way that they sound. And, you know, and many of them have decayed and have no arms, as Bobby said. So it's pretty easy to distinguish the, you know, quote-unquote combatants from the non-combatants, if I can use that framing. But, you know, as the contagion spreads and the zombies are occupying more portions of, let's say, cities where there are people held up in buildings and they've boarded the windows shut and they're holding them off, do we have an obligation to not attack those hordes knowing that there may be innocent and presumably uninfected people inside? Or do we how do we weigh the question of collateral damage? When is it okay to know that you're going to kill some number of uninfected people possibly by, you know, killing a large number of zombies? Jen, what do you think about that?
Right. So this just goes back to the whole framing question, which I just think it's interesting that we all have jumped to the assumption that we're going to engage in an armed conflict with the zombies, and that while Shane, you pose the possibility of us employing the CDC and public health measures and a range of other tools, we keep jumping back to the assumption that we're going to employ armed conflict in a framework of armed conflict, that we're going to use force in the framework of an armed conflict, which is where the term collateral damage doesn't even, it's not even a term of art that would make sense unless we're in an armed conflict. Yeah. So taking that as an assumption that we're actually in an armed conflict with the zombies, then, I mean, it's a classic question of proportionality. Is the military target, is there a disproportionate number of non-combatant civilian non-zombie deaths that are anticipated relative to the military advantage gained? And these are inherently difficult calculations to make. They're viewed from the perspective of those who are making decisions to attack before it happens, not in hindsight. So certainly if we're in an armed conflict, we can expect collateral damage, and that's permissible. And the fact that the zombies are hiding out in cities and in apartment buildings means that the likelihood of collateral damage is going to increase. All the more reason that we should take seriously and maybe start with CDC, other public health measures. If we can come up with some sort of prison system where the zombies can be safely contained in their own prison, so there's no fear of them biting other inmates or guards, a panopticon type prison, maybe that's an option as well.
And it makes me think whether there's an obligation to rescue before there's even an obligation to attack in some of these cases. I mean, particularly if we know that there are civilians, uninfected people being surrounded by the zombies.
The capture or kill, the preference of capture over kill as a matter of law is controversial even with respect to full-fledged humans, you know, and, people like Ryan Goodman have urged that it is law, but that's not well accepted. And I think the argument that when you're dealing with, relentless flesh-eating ghouls, that the standard should be higher than it is with respect to even lawful human combatants, that would be a little bit hard to sustain. Jen does raise a really important point here, though, which is why are we jumping to the assumption that we're dealing with this in an armed conflict setting? And I want to pose two possible reasons for that. One is just that, look, the pop culture always frames it as eventually, you know, hordes of zombies facing, you know, paramilitary and military units. And that may be infecting our thinking, so to speak. But there is one substantive reason that I think you have to think about this, at least think about thinking about this in the language of armed conflict, and that is that there is in our culture and knowledge and experience only one way to neutralize a zombie threat, and that is to put a bullet in the brain and to destroy the brain. And so, you know, I would love to see, you know, a Guantanamo for zombies. But right now we have not figured out how to safely capture, safely detain, much less to do so on the sort of mass scale that we may have to think about. And under those circumstances, the single bullet to the head, you know, does raise armed conflict images and kind of puts you in armed conflict land.
And I think for a lot of people that it raises the cruel and unusual punishment issues. It raises the question of whether or not, as a number of people believe, the zombies can actually be redeemed. I mean, literally that the flesh can be redeemed and they can be turned back. And so this question has come up, you know, many times of whether or not, you know, there's the obligation to capture them and then to detain them until such point that we can figure out how to reverse the plague or whatever it is that has turned them. You know, and that leads to a separate question too, I guess, related. Bobby, let me pose this to you, which is, you know, it's pretty fundamental, but do zombies have due process rights?
Well, certainly American zombies do. I'll start there. You know, one question that lurks behind that question, though, is could we prosecute the zombies? Were we able to effectuate captures and otherwise maintain enough security to have that option? And I think any defense counsel worth their salt will have a pretty good time of it challenging the mens rea elements for various violent crime charges that might be brought. And, of course, conspiracy is not going to work because you can't have a meeting of the minds amongst multiple zombies. They're all operating independently and hungrily. The criminal justice options may be few and far between, and we might instead be better off thinking about civil commitment type strategies. But, again, that all presupposes an ability to capture that, at least according to the work of the scholar Max Brooks, are pretty much difficult to effectuate. And I'm concerned that it may be that all we really have are the options to the single bullet to the head, or more realistically perhaps the daisy cutter dropped from above over large groups, which of course brings us back to Jen's concern about how do you handle proportionality here, and when you do the collateral damage estimation. What you have from the intel from the birds overhead shows that you've got, well, you're not using the category of military age males here, are we? Because really anybody of any age, even a crawling baby, could kill you if crawls close enough to infect you with the bite. Indeed they have. There are some particularly vicious zombie babies out there. Is everyone a military age male on this subject to targeting? Proportionality becomes a real mess in this situation.
Let me throw out what may be just a provocative, you know, statement, but you know, in terms of proportionality, I know that the zombies aren't sentient per se, but they're clearly driven, you know, by an insatiable appetite for human brains. It would seem to me that they've clearly declared their intention not to stop until they've eaten all the brains or turned everyone into a zombie. So isn't the proportional response to them total annihilation?
I think that just because an entity or a group, or in this case the zombies, desire total annihilation doesn't necessarily mean that the response has to be total annihilation back. I mean, I think that there are, as Bobby just pointed out, alternatives, quarantines certainly jump to mind, as Bobby was talking about, and the possibility of containing the threat rather than necessarily destroying the threat. Obviously, in the situation of zombies, the ultimate goal would be to destroy, because they will continue to perpetuate and propagate and continue to to fester if we don't completely destroy them. But that doesn't necessarily mean annihilation, especially if you take seriously the hope that there will someday be some cure for the zombie disease.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, there've been those who have pointed out that, you know, it doesn't exactly stop them, but the zombies can actually be held at bay to some degree by eating rats. And I guess this raises the question of, you know, if we can, in other words, if we can sort of distract them and they can be content with rats and maybe not eat humans so much, maybe you could argue that their intention isn't to totally eat us and wipe us out, and maybe that affects the proportionality question.
It's very hard to argue for appeasement in this context, though. I mean, you know, leave aside what humanitarian obligations we may have to the rats in question. You know, if you give a zombie a rat, he wants something larger the next day. And, you know, we've experienced this with terrorist groups where, you know, you try to pay a ransom and then that just incentivizes them to go for bigger targets and go for more targets. And I think you would really have something serious and similar with, you know, an attempt to sort of satiate the zombie appetite with rodents.
Yeah, I think that you raise a good point, Ben. Another question that's come up in the science, and this is a controversial point, as you all well know. But the question has been raised of if the zombie plague is the result of an infection. There are those who think that it is actually the result of some kind of genetic anomaly, and those, as you know, who have suggested that everyone is already a carrier, and that effectively we're all about to become zombies. This is there are people who argue that you become a zombie when you've turned, and that it doesn't have to be because you were bitten by a zombie that you can just die a natural cause and come back as one. That's a controversial point, and the science is not borne out. But let's say, for the sake of argument, that is true, that we are all already infected. How does that change the contours of the response, and does that necessitate a different kind of response if we are all effectively, we're all potential zombies? Ben, take that, if you will, and I want to hear what the others think, too.
Well, so this gets to the question of how do you distinguish the zombie from the person, right? And, you know, as you pointed out earlier, at close range, it can be pretty clear from the way they walk and move, although I have to say I have known some people who walk in very zombie-like fashions, and, you know, you don't want a situation in which, you know, the authorities have the ability to terminate on site anybody who's sort of, you know, driving while zombie-like or something.
Right. We've talked about zombie profiling before.
Right. And that's, you know, that's a real concern. And so I think the, you know, if you imagine that we're all a little bit more zombie-like than we think, because we all carry that potential with us all the time, that problem gets worse. And then maybe you think that there needs to be some serious process before terminating the zombie or detaining the zombie before to make sure you're actually dealing with the walking dead rather than, you know, a sort of peculiar person. And this, you know, reminds me a little bit of the Article 5 tribunals contemplated for law of war detention under the Geneva Conventions, where, you know, you have just to have some sort of process so that, you know you're not, your field commanders aren't making grievous mistakes. And, you know, maybe you could contemplate some sort of habeas process or judicial review. But I think the more you imagine that the average human is a little bit like the average zombie, and may have a little bit of brain eating, you know, in their minds, I think the more that process becomes probably necessary.
Bobby, what do you think? If we're already infected, what's the response?
Look, I think Ben put his finger on something important there, and it highlights the real problem of the risk of false positives that sometimes can be associated with a signature strike methodology. You are running a greater risk, and at least if you've got American citizen zombie targets, the question arises if the executive branch within itself is going through a process of vetting targeting packages and looking at the intelligence and coming to a judgment as to whether the guy in the video feed from the Reaper is in fact, you know, is a stumbling drunk or is that actually a zombie? If it's a citizen, there's an argument we need to at least consider strongly the possibility that some further process, possibly involving a judge, somehow gets worked in there. Although I say that, and then you run up against the problem of you may only have seconds, because as the zombie on the video feed, or possibly the drunk person on the video feed, as they come around the corner, there's a family there. There's no time to go to a judge. There can be brains on the floor in moments if you've made the wrong decision. So.
And, of course, there is that also the involvement of judges does raise the issue of zombieism in the judiciary itself, which is, you know, something we have to keep in mind.
That there already might be judges that are zombies, you mean?
Often cloaked.
Yeah, well, indeed. Yeah. Jen, what do you think about this question if we're already infected? And as you're answering that, too, I wonder if you might even take up a related question. Should we consider creating a special zombie court to deal with these kinds of scenarios, like the one that Bobby was raising about using force against zombies in the drone context?
Right. So I think this raises really interesting and important questions about both preventive justice and anticipatory self-defense and the difficult and deep problems that we have when we try to detain or take actions against individuals or groups before they have acted. And as Ben and Bobby both pointed out, the real risks of false positives. Certainly, review helps, and having both ex ante and ex post review, if there is even if there has been a targeted killing operation, to review what happened afterwards to determine whether or not the decisions were made correctly, whether or not our target was actually who we thought he or she was this individual actually a zombie or not, and hopefully learning from those mistakes certainly would help. But once we go down the route of targeting people before they've actually engaged in a zombie, an offensive zombie act, before they've actually taken lethal action as a zombie, then we always run the risk of false positives. On the other hand, if we wait, it could be too late. So it's a deep, deep dilemma. I did want to just respond to something that Bobby said, which was interesting. I thought that he's assumed that zombies in the United States are entitled to due process protections, and that, of course, assumes the answer to the very first question you posed to us, Shane, is whether or not zombies are in fact persons that are covered by the Fifth Amendment.
Yeah.
Shane, if I may, this is Bobby, I wanted to jump in with something that we haven't mentioned yet, but I think it's very important because it makes all these questions so much harder to answer, and that is the incredible operational security or tradecraft that is inherent in the zombie threat. These guys, SIGINT is useless against them. They just... everything is kept to themselves. You never hear of or have any communications to tap into. And it really renders moot the entire apparatus of SIGINT collection for the most part. And, of course, human intelligence is an alternative in theory, but it is my understanding that it is proven very, very difficult for us to place human agents posing as zombies amidst zombie hordes.
Yeah, it's been a very it's almost impossible. They kind of get found out, don't they?
Yeah.
They get turned.
Yeah.
Well, this has also come up again. I mean, you talk about the intelligence problem of this. I mean, the really only effective, and it's not great, intelligence that we've had to try and deal with a threat has been reconnaissance. So it's been overhead with satellites. It's been a lot of drones. It's been, you know, and this has led to, in many parts of the country and in other parts of the world too, persistent surveillance from drones, which, of course, you know, back before the global war on zombies began, we were having a very lively debate about what would happen when, you know, everyone could have their own drone, and, you know, Amazon was talking about flying drones back when Amazon existed. And, you know, I know that this debate has sort of been, you know, sidelined a bit, but I wonder what each of you might take a little crack at it. To the extent that we now have persistent cameras in the sky trying to spot these zombies, and they're all, of course, looking at all of us to see if we're zombies too, I mean, do we need to be talking about how we sort of level off and ratchet down that persistent intelligence gathering, particularly if it's not working particularly well, very well? You know, Ben, do you want to take that?
Look, I mean, I like my privacy as well as the next man, but I prefer to be not eaten on camera than to be lunch in private. And so I'm actually personally willing to contemplate a lot of aerial surveillance to make sure that, you know, large hordes of people who want to eat me are not, you know, pouring toward my house. Now, where I draw the line, and I think we can probably all agree on this, is that, you know, where there are no known zombie hordes, surveillance should focus not on downtown areas, but on perimeters. Because I think the key surveillance strategy is to prevent the zombies from coming in the first place. Once they're walking among you, that's really a house-to-house, line-of-sight kind of thing for armed people.
Mm-hmm. Let's take the due process thing one step further. We don't have this system quite in place yet, but assuming that we did have the ability to bring the zombies in and to try them for attempted murder or for murder, how would we go about comprising a jury of their peers? Jen, do you want to talk about that?
Yes. I mean, I think juries have never had to be exactly alike the people that are being tried. So as long as it's assuming that the zombies came from the community, at least historically, I think that we can have, I mean, we certainly can't risk having a jury of zombies. So we have to have a jury of people from the community from which the zombie came. And that's about as close as we can get, and it's pretty good.
Is a zombie, you know, in Los Angeles who has eaten or been a part of something that's, you know, a horde that's eaten thousands of people going to get a fair trial in Los Angeles? Maybe this raises the question of a special court or something again, but it seems like venue change would be, you know, any defense attorney worth his salt would automatically argue for a venue change every time that his client was indicted, no?
Although, you know, in the past, whenever we have tried to try zombies, there has been the problem of defense attorneys being eaten. And,
right.
I mean, I just think you can't overstate the practical difficulties of bringing zombies to trial. And, you know, the cases that we've actually attempted have taken years. There has been a lot of litigation. You know, building a new court system is hard. And you know, those of us, and I've been an advocate for it in the past, and those of us who've done that have been, you know, chastened, I think, by the practical experience, which has not been attractive.
Guys, I think I may have the answer. And so if you'll bear with me. But hold on a second. There's someone at my office door.
Okay, sure.
Yeah. Oh my.
Oh no.
I think we've lost Bobby.
Well, I think with Bobby gone, out of respect for him and his colleagues in Texas, we should probably end the discussion there. I want to thank the late Bobby Chesney for joining us. Ben and Jen, thank you so much for your insightful comments as well, and be safe out there.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is, as ever, performed by Sophia Yan. We need your help promoting the podcast. Tweet it, share it on Facebook, review it on iTunes or Stitcher. When the zombie apocalypse comes, The Walking Dead are going first to the people who haven't done their part to spread their word about the Lawfare Podcast. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.